Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Gene Logsdon. He is my favorite living Ohio writer. Welcome back, Gene.
Well, thank you very much. You're making me nervous. You sure? I'm used to hearing people say, "Well, you know, I hear you." Sometimes I agree.
Well, Gene, I said that because having read your new book, I thought I sure am glad that Gene is still around for me to call up and talk to.
So am I.
Your new book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. And you wrote this because you had a health scare here in the last couple years.
Yes, I did. I you know, when you're young, and for me that was forever, you know, I just thought, well, there's no such thing as dying. You know, that happened to other people. And I found out I had cancer. And so it was a bit nervy, you know, a bit scary time, yes. But it's in recession now, and so let's just think about it that way.
You live on a farm, and you're still active with the pastoral life, but you've also been writing for a long time. And in this new book, you make the observation that as a writer, quote, "Dying is the best story we will ever cover."
Yes, well, that's true. But as I go on to say there, you know, it's practice makes perfect. So the more you know a subject, the better you can write about it. But you don't have that chance with dying. you do it once.
This new book is a collection of reflections and meditations, essays on various things, and a lot of them tie into that thought of, well, we're not going to be here forever. And one thing that you reflect on that you would think is going to always be there is a pasture, but you realized over the years that pastures are kind of impermanent things, aren't they?
Yes, they are, much more than you grow up playing on a pasture, you know, and working on it, and everything. You just think that's the way it's always been. And as I've learned and say in that chapter, they're really quite impermanent. They were, in this part of the country anyway, really woodlands in the beginning, and when we cut down all the trees, cleared the land, and then put sheep on it, and sheep were very common here for a century or so. They kept it permanent, quote and unquote, and so in the last 30 years since we moved back here, I've watched there's no longer very much livestock in our whole county, and hardly any out on grazing land, and also the type of permanent pastures, quote and unquote, that I'm used to. They're small river creek valleys, and it's not enough room and not practical to farm corn and soybeans, you know, with big machinery. It's not efficient or profitable. And so this little valley that I grew up in right next to me, well, my land is part of it, actually, it's growing back to thickets. And the thickets are already, the new trees are coming up in them. And in another century, it'll be forest again, unless somebody comes along and cleans it out. So it was kind of a soul-searing realization to figure that how impermanent the most permanent thing in my life is, you know.
Gene, it's been a while since we had you on the program. Why don't you tell our listeners what part of Ohio you live in?
It's in Wyandotte County. It's about midway between Toledo and Columbus, and so you all know, right north of Marion, a little town of Upper Sandusky is my hometown, and it is fairly level, except in the creek valleys, and it is almost, the agriculture has gone almost entirely to large-scale industrial corn and soybeans, and, a few big animal factories, I call them, but mostly it's typical, agriculturally speaking, it's typical Corn Belt country.
Gene Logsdon joins us. His new book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. I was looking at your blog, and I think our listeners would be intrigued by some of your blog entries. If you want to check out his blog, just put Gene Logsdon in your Google search, and one of the first things you'll get is Gene Logsdon blog. And I saw you were talking about this book coming out, and you said something along the lines of, if you can read this book without shedding a tear, I'll refund your money.
That's kind of a stupid thing to say, I suppose. Well, but I think I'll hang in with that, yeah.
Well, you got me. I shed a few tears, and one of the essays that really made me choke up was the one called Kill Deer Woman.
Uh-huh.
It's about your mother.
Yes. It's an old essay. It appeared first in Farm Journal magazine, oh, Lordy, many years ago. And one of the first things I wrote, to tell you the truth, and I still think it just fit perfectly into this book, and so it went in. It's about how she died, my mother died, accidentally falling out of the haymow at home. And she was only 58, so it was a real, real shock to the whole family. And most of us were, the children were all fairly young yet, so it was a very sad time.
Well, it's very powerful, and also you get a real sense of what you're getting at in this book by the ending, which I'm not going to give away. Another one that really got me was called Maybe God is a Pure Red Iris.
Uh-huh.
I love that essay.
Well, thank you. I'll give you a little background. You want a little background? I mean, you know, at that time I was working for Farm Journal on their editorial staff in Philadelphia. And we were living on the outskirts of that great big city and never was very, very comfortable there. But we lived in an area that was very unusual in that it wasn't exactly country and it wasn't exactly suburban either. It was sort of in between. And the old man who lived across the road from us was a master gardener. And he sort of befriended me, to tell you the truth, and then I just started going over there all the time because even though I had been brought up on a farm, what I knew about farming was milking cows and running big tractors, and here was a man who had on just not even half an acre, about half an acre, no, three-quarters of an acre, now I'm remembering, had built a self-subsistent life that was just remarkable. He had chickens, he had rabbits, he had all the vegetables and fruit that he needed, and he also grew flowers and sold them. So he had it like his own little business there. And I was really affected by him because he was teaching me that you could have a real farm and real farm life on a very small acreage. And I knew, or I surely didn't think I would ever going to be able to afford more than a few acres, but, you know, even then I was planning on moving back to a farm. So anyway, I listened to him and watched him, and he taught me so many things. He taught me how to breed flowers. He was growing iris, and he was trying to grow one that was pure red. I don't think there are any pure red iris even today, but that was his goal as his, you know, his business along with his way of life there. And so as he grew weaker and weaker, we lived next to him for 9 years. And, you know, it was obvious that at some point he was going to have to retire and move to an old folks home, I suppose, as we called them, old folks home. You're not supposed to say that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we fell into conversation. He was thinking about death, and he'd ask me, you know, provocative questions about what I thought about death. And of course, at the time, I didn't think anything about it because I was never going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about raising or growing iris, and he wanted to know, you know, what do you think about dying? He asked me one day, real abruptly, and of course, I had never, you know, really done any thinking about it. But as the conversation went on, it just seemed an appropriate place, and it popped into my mind without thinking, really. I said, he's talking about dying and what, you know, what happened. And I said, maybe God is a pure red iris.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he caught on immediately, and he was not a talkative man at all, but he got this strange smile on his face, and he nodded. And you could tell that he thought that was a pretty, maybe that made his life there even more worthwhile. His search for red iris is really his search for God.
Mm. Yeah, you nailed it on that one. That was great to see you in that young incarnation where you hadn't thought about death, and now all these years later, you're looking back and you were feeling kind of weak from the chemotherapy that you got for your treatment. And in one of your essays, Garden Therapy Along with Chemotherapy, you were just strong enough to sit out there in the garden and do a little weeding in a chair. And you started looking around you, didn't you? You started noticing a lot of things like bugs that you hadn't really paid much attention to.
Yes. There's just so many details in a garden, in a yard, in a small woodland. You know, you could spend your whole life just studying the life that was there, you know, and in great detail, it becomes very dramatic. And so there I was, you know, I was too weak to stand up and hoe, really. And I'd be crawling around in this case, in the black raspberry patch, pulling the weeds out. And I just began to notice all the life there. And it was just remarkable. I had already, I'm sure in many things that I had written, you know, preached that line. But this was, I was actually living it and proving it to myself. And out of it came, you know, a discovery that I don't think, well, I'm sure the scientists know, but how many different bugs, insects, are pollinators? You know, I'm real deep into bees, you know, losing all our bees, and so we're losing all our pollination. And I found all these different kinds of bugs that were landing on the raspberry blossoms, and obviously they were pollinating because they'd go down in the blossom, you know. And so I got the insect book out, and just, you know, there were like I think about 15 different kinds of bugs that I couldn't even identify until I got the bug book out, that were actually pollinating. And so what they were saying in their silent little way was that, you know, it's not the end of the world if all our honeybees died off. I mean, it would be terrible, but it would not really stop nature. And then, of course, I realized that honeybees aren't even native to the United States. So
that's an amazing thing. I don't think most people in this debate about honeybees possibly going extinct realized that they weren't here before.
Right. Neither was bluegrass, one of our greatest plants.
Speaking of plants, I mean, you're looking at bugs, you're looking at birds, animals, you look at all this stuff around you, but you really look closely at plants. In fact, you've got a couple of essays about specific plants that have bedeviled you over the years. One of them's Intimations of Immortality, Chickweed, and the other one is Intimations of Immortality, Pigweed. I think most of our listeners probably don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about these particular plants.
Well, it It's interesting. I mean, if they're gardeners, they think about them, I guarantee, because they can be very pestiferous. And yet, when you start studying them and their history, you know, they can be or really are very beneficial plants in their own way, in their own place. And so it's another case of where they're considered weeds, but they really, really have been lifesavers, you know, in different ways in different civilizations, especially pigweed, you know, amaranth. And this new kind of pigweed that's moving north now, and it's almost immune to all kinds of herbicides. Yeah, it just nothing kills it. In fact, it seems to grow better with a little squirt of all of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the common
Roundup. Herbicide.
Roundup. Uh-huh, thank you.
Yeah.
And so, amaranth, pigweed, was one of the major food sources for ancient man, you know, in the Mayan civilization and even in North American, the mound builder, woodland Indian civilization, they depended on pigweed like we depend on corn.
Huh. Wow. That's pretty amazing. The book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. Gene Longston joins us. And how old are you now, Gene? 82, is it?
82, yes.
Wow. You have a essay in there that I was particularly fond of. I'm very fond of turkey vultures. We have a lot of them around this
area. Oh, you are?
I love them.
So do I, yeah.
and you've got an essay in there called Buzzard Bait. And so this was a real winner for me.
Are you like from the, are you a country boy?
I live in the country, and I see turkey vultures every day. They're still around, even in the winter.
Yes, they are. Now, I need to ask you, is this the black vulture, or is this the turkey? You're talking about the ordinary buzzard that we see all the time.
These are turkey vultures, I'm pretty sure.
And they're staying there all winter, you're saying?
Yep.
Huh. That's new to me now. I've heard people say that you see them all winter in southern Ohio now, but this is the first time I've really talked to somebody. Ours leave, you know. They're very perfunctory almost in their schedule. They leave right around, or they come here right around March 14th, 15th, 16th every year, it seems like, and then leave on schedule two. So I was not aware that you're in Dayton there, you know, and I was not aware that they stayed there over winter. The other kind of vulture, which is not as nearly as beneficial to humankind anyway, to our, they stay, but they're not up this far. They're mostly a southern bird anyway.
Those are the black ones?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm talking like as if I'm an expert on them, but I'm not.
Well, I get up pretty close to them because you'll see them massed when they find some particular piece of roadkill they like. I'll go by on my bicycle, and I look at them pretty closely, and I'm pretty positive these are turkey vultures.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm sure they are if they're out like that. Do you ride your bicycle to work? Or?
I ride my bicycle as much as I can all year long.
Bless you.
I haven't been doing it much lately because I've been kind of down under the weather, but... Yeah, it's good exercise. You get to see nature.
Oh, it's so, you know, it's so much better than riding in a car. You know, if you go out country roads on a bicycle, you see, there again, you see just see so much more than you do when you're in a car. Yeah, those turkey vultures, of course, we call them buzzards. And when they're, I go into it in the book quite a bit there, but when they are eating a carcass out in the field, a dead sheep in my case, they are at once, I don't know, there's something beautiful about them and yet something that's just shivery, fearful. And I had the experience of there were like six of them on six fence posts back in the pasture when I came over the hill, and the dead animal, the dead sheep, was down, and there were like maybe 10 more down there eating, and they have the most gross habits of eating you ever saw.
Yeah.
It's almost revolting. But the six on the fence post, you know, this is something, an animal very common, I'm always stressing that, something we see every day, but we don't appreciate the majesty of it. Those six, as I walked toward them very slowly so they wouldn't fly away, they raised their wings up.
Uh-huh.
And their wingspread is over 6 feet. And they just absolutely, you know, it just sent chills up your spine. It was so dramatic and so beautiful in its ugly way.
Yeah, they're magnificent, but they're not pretty.
They're not pretty.
No.
They're ugly. There's no doubt about it. You know,
yeah.
All black and those little bald red heads.
Well, this essay got me to thinking, particularly because of the subject matter of your book, about how some cultures, Native American, and even some current practices in places like India actually incorporate vultures into disposing of those humans who have passed on.
Well, you know, you're telling me something I wasn't sure of. I suggested it in my book, and then I got to thinking it's perfectly logical and natural to do that, don't you think?
Yeah.
It really is?
There's a group in India that I've read about over the years. It's a smaller religious sect where they actually have dedicated areas where they will put their dead for the vultures, and they've had a problem because they give some sort of a drug to cattle in India, and then the vultures that eat the dead cattle get this drug, and it does something to their reproductive ability, and the vultures have become almost extinct because of this drug in
Goodness.
Their system. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I'm intrigued by all this stuff. Did you happen to see the article yesterday in the New York Times about the sloth, the three-toed sloth that has a unique type of moth that lives in its fur? And
yes,
only,
I did.
Wasn't that a
yes,
great...
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I'm a faithful New York Times Sunday reader, you know. They have so many interesting stories that directly bear on rural life. That's what always gets me, you know. You think New York Times.
Uh-huh.
But that sloth, oh, my.
That was really something. We've had Verlin Klinkenborg on the program several times, and it kind of broke my heart when I saw he retired.
I hadn't even known he retired. His book, Making Hay, is one of my favorites.
We had him on for that book, and he's not doing the rural life column anymore. He's finally gone out to pasture.
Yeah, he's a great writer. And, you know, they have on the flap of the book, I didn't know this, that he made a nice remark about me, about my writing.
I'll bet he did.
And, it's you know, it's right there, and I was just flabbergasted. I consider him, you know, well, I knew he was a farm boy, and then he wrote a lot of books about farming, but I don't know, New York Times, that seems like so beyond my threshold. I was really surprised.
One of the points that you make in Gene Everlasting is that we're all just kind of part of the food chain in a way, and there's a real continuum, a real continuity to our presence here and our absence. And you make the statement, quote, "There is no beginning or ending in the real world, but only the forever now," capitalized.
Well, I certainly believe that, but, you know, it took me a long time to get to that. You know, it's one thing to become convinced of something, but then, you know, you make yourself a pest to others if you start coming on like as if you know the ultimate answers to everything. And so it's hard to write a book like this and say the things that I think, and that I'm convinced are the truth, and yet do so in a way that doesn't turn off people who have other ways of looking at mortality, immortality, and the idea that the food chain, people just seem to rebel against the idea that we're all sitting around this big dining table eating and being eaten, you know, all at once. And when you try to, you know, in a speech or something, try to show them this, there's lots of, it's a repelling thought to a lot of people, I guess I'll put it that way.
Gene Logsdon joins us. His new book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. And we've had Gene on the program on a number of occasions. And you write about so many different things. I always get a kick when I go through your bibliography and see, you know, you've written about farm ponds. You've written about your days in the seminary. You've written novels. You've written about making booze at home. You've covered so many subjects. And I see where one of your more recent books has a title that I can't say on public radio, but it's about the glory of manure.
Yeah, holy manure.
Right.
Well, if you can't say it, I've been, you know, through this before. Public radio doesn't allow you to say one of the most common words in the English language, and I get a big kick out of that.
What was your point in that book? I confess I have not read that particular
one. Well, it's about manure, about waste, you know, animal manure and human manure, and how we're throwing this stuff away or not using it. It's getting better now, but especially human defecation. You know, we spend millions of dollars trying to get rid of it, and it's could be a source of very, very valuable fertilizer. And so the point of the book was, as the subtitle says, you know, saving.
Okay.
But using manure to save mankind, that's the idea. That if we must face up to the problem of our waste and getting rid of it in an intelligent and economical manner. So that's what the book's about, how to use manure, all kinds of manure, safely and profitably.
So your basic point is we should really start giving a blank.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Well, Gene, I'm looking at the clock, and I can't believe that we've already whiled away our allotted time, but it's so good to talk to you again.
It's fun. I really enjoy talking to you.
My guest has been Gene Logsdon. His new book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever, published by a really nifty publisher called Chelsea Green. Gene, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSL. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.
This new book by Gene Logsdon is really wonderful. Here's a little excerpt for you. I think cancer drove me to write more rather than less, for the same reason that a fruit tree will increase output if its bark is lacerated with cuts and slashes. Threatened with danger, the writer, as well as the apple tree, is frightened into greater production. Pecking away on a keyboard does not require much physical energy, and my mind seemed to be just seething with deathbed drama. I have read about quite a few other writers who continued to write frantically, it seemed, till the day they died. Is that accepting death or fighting it? The secret of writing is to see everything, however common and nondescript, as drama, and certainly nothing is more dramatic than dying. Gene Logsdon, in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.